Okay, so I'd like to thank the organisers for inviting me to speak here. So we've heard quite a lot about the Gower's norms in various talks this week, but it's early in the morning. Some of us went out last night, and it's probably best to start reasonably slowly. Now let me start very, very slowly and make a couple of preliminary remarks on what finite field models are. So that is the setting where a lot of very well-known questions in additive combinatorics, such as Semmeradi's theorem, are asked. And for many of those questions, Feynman's theorem as well, for many of those questions, there are analogues inside Fp to the n. So p here is to be thought of as fixed, and I've scarcely ever been able to think of p being other than 2, 3, and 5 myself. N is somewhat large, and this is, of course, a set of n tuples. So the reason I write 5, for example, is that you can think of a four-term progression inside F5 to the n. You can think of it inside F2 and F3 as well, but it's not so interesting there. So any question such as Semmeradi's theorem, take a set of positive density in here, does it contain a progression of length 4, say? Or Feynman's theorem, take a set of small doubling inside here, what's its structure? These questions can be asked here, and they're often much easier to address in that setting. And for a long time, at least, that was the point of view generally taken with the so-called Gower's norms. So let G be any group, any finite abelian group. And then, actually, I don't think Tim Gower's called them the Gower's norms. He called them the UK norms. But the Gower's UK norms are defined as follows. Let f from G to the complex numbers, say, be a function. So, as Tim did in his talk, I'll just write down the first two and say that engineer's induction or something will let you write down the remaining series. So the U2 norm to the power 4 is the average of f over parallelograms. And the U3 norm is the average of f over three-dimensional parallelepipeds. So as usual, as we've seen in many talks, expectation is, I just mean average. It avoids having to think about normalizing factors. And I'll skip the motivation for this basic question, but one is interested in when these norms can be large. As Tim has discussed in some detail why one would be interested in that question, it has to do with governing the behavior of arithmetic progressions of various lengths along a function f or inside a set A. So the inverse question for the Gower's norms. So we call this the IEG of S when is, well, what can you say if the U S plus 1 norm of a function F is large? So starting from an assumption such as that this big average along three-dimensional parallelepipeds is large, can you say anything more usable about the function f? Now, Tim has discussed this quite a bit in his first two lectures, and he mentioned a rather unpleasant to state theorem of myself and Tao, building very much on his own work, which answers this question to an extent, inside Z modulo NZ, or roughly equivalently inside the interval M. So in that setting, the answer is, well, if F in U2 is large, that implies, and is implied by F has a large Fourier coefficient, or correlates with a linear exponential. Okay, so there's nothing unpleasant about that. But the answer for the U3 norm was significantly less pleasant to state. A function has a large U3 norm if it correlates with one of these local quadratic phase functions. An equivalent way of stating this is to say that F correlates with a two-step null sequence. Neither of those is particularly easy to explain, and I'm not going to do so because it would be too much of a diversion. The nice thing about the finite field setting is that the corresponding results are much, much easier to explain, much, much cleaner, and easier to prove. Well, at least as far as that. So here's a theorem by myself and Tao from 2004 or something. For definiteness, let's work inside F5 to the n, or FP to the n. For any fixed p greater than or equal to 3, this is how these inverse theorems look. So you can do Fourier analysis on any one of these groups, just as in Z modulo NZ, to get that the U2 norm of a function is large if and only if it correlates with a linear exponential. And the U3 norm is large. Well, in the finite field world, there are no local quadratic phases or two-step null sequences. There are just pure quadratic phases. So, to be completely explicit, something like e to the 2 pi I over P times just a quadratic form, X transpose MX plus R transpose X, something like that, when written in bases. So obviously, if you're going to try and prove these statements, I think most people would be much more inclined to try and prove this one before proving this one. And that was indeed the perspective that Tao and I took. The size of so P is fixed. As I said, I P is either 2, 3, or 5. N is big, sort of. Yes. I should say, I must mention as well that Samrodnitsky extended this to P equals 2. No, because that, well, there is, but it's that theorem. This is definitely in the regime of fixed P and N growing. So in particular, what I mean by correlate depends on P. Right. So I actually think it's fair to say that there's no way that Tao and I would have been able to prove that theorem had we not first proved this finite field version. Because it's somehow so much nicer to deal with genuinely quadratic phases where you can do linear algebra than with these, well, with either the local quadratic phase functions or the null sequences. But unfortunately, at that point, finite fields let us down. So there was a very natural conjecture at this point, which was that this generalizes in the most obvious way. So suppose that, so this is all in f to the p, f sub p to the n. Suppose that the US plus 1 norm of f is at least delta, then f correlates with a genuinely degree s phase. So e to the 2 pi I over p phi of x, where the s plus first derivative of phi is 0. So that conjecture is due to myself and Tao, and I'm quite fond of telling this story, but I think it does bear repetition. After it was falsified, which I'm about to tell you, Sam Rudnitsky decided that he wanted his name added to it as well. So we very generously did so. Yes, anyway, I've spoiled the surprise now. So that very natural conjecture that degree S phases are the only obstruction to having large Gauss US plus 1 norm is false. And actually, Alex Samarodnitsky talked about this. I'm also going to talk about it to some extent from a somewhat different viewpoint. But I can just tell you an example. So the function, so e to the 2 pi I g of x, where g of x is the symmetric quartic polynomial, I less than j less than k less than l, xi, xj, xk, xl. So that has large U4 norm. But does not correlate with a cubic. So I'm being quite vague about what I mean by correlate. What I mean there is that the U4 norm of that is actually an absolute constant greater than zero, asymptotically. But there exists no delta such that the inner product of this with an exponential in a cubic is greater than or equal to delta. Actually, there's a similar example. Well, the symmetric polynomials. Oh, sorry, this is in f2 to the n. So the symmetric polynomials are also a counterexample. In degree, so this was U4, in any power of 2. So for any power of 2 greater than or equal to 4. So that very natural conjecture turns out to be false. Sorry? Yes, I'm just going to mention that now. By the way, this is all joint work with Terence Tao in a paper called The Distribution of Polynomials Over Finite Fields or something like that. Yeah, so that was rather embarrassing for us, this conjecture turned out to be false, but we have managed to salvage a few things from it. So one theorem is essentially that if the characteristic is large enough, there is no such counterexample. So suppose that, so let d and k be integers, and suppose that p the characteristic of the field is bigger than both D and K. Then the most natural inverse conjecture is true for polynomials of degree K. So suppose that P from, so it's capital P, from Fp to the m to Fp is a polynomial of degree K, and that its u to the d plus 1 norm is large. So the u to the d plus 1 norm of e to the 2 pi I over p, p of x. Sorry? So I'm asking the inverse Gauss problem in the specific case of degree k polynomials. And the assertion of this theorem is that it's true. So there is q from fp to the n to fp of degree d with the inner product of e to the 2 pi I over p times p and e to the 2 pi I over p times q bounded below. So bounded below depending on d, k and delta. So the way one should read this theorem is, if the characteristic is high enough, then a simple polynomial example will not give you a counterexample to the inverse conjecture. So although it's false, it's probably only slightly false. And actually, we have a corresponding theorem about nil sequences, for those of you who remember about nil sequences. And there, the theorem is that there is no counterexample to the inverse conjecture amongst the class of nil sequences. So to find a counterexample to the conjecture in Z mod nZ, you'll have to do something very exotic. Now, of course, this is not uniform in K, so you can't just approximate an arbitrary function by a sum of polynomials and hope to get the thing everywhere. So that's really just to be thought of as ruling out counterexamples. Yep. So by far, in my opinion, by far the most interesting ingredient in that paper was a lemma about the distribution of polynomials. So I mean, asking about the Gauss norm of polynomials is one thing, but at some point we realized that some of the most basic questions about the distribution of multivariate polynomials did not appear to have been addressed in the literature. So here's a question. Now I'm aware that I'll try to avoid using little p and big p. So let capital F. No. Q. From fp to the n to fp be a polynomial of degree d and suppose that q is not close to being equidistributed. So one way of measuring that, so you could say that the expected value of e to the 2 pi I over p q of x is greater or equal to delta. That might be one way of detecting bias. In F2, when p is 2, this is just saying something like 49% of the q takes the value 0 49% of the time and the value 1 51% of the time. So suppose you have a polynomial like that. What can one say about Q? And so far as I'm aware, well, singular, yeah, I'll believe that. So that question can be addressed by sort of very classical means when D is 1. So if you have a linear polynomial, it's either trivial or it's equal distributed. And when D is 2, if you have a quadratic polynomial, it's either equal distributed or the matrix defining it has low rank. And you can prove that using Gauss sums. So the answer when D equals 2 is that M has low rank. Now we know what the rank of a matrix is. It's the dimension of the space spanned by the rows or the columns. But it turns out that we don't seem to know what the rank of a 3 tensor is in any sensible way.
P is
always fixed. Can I just say to everybody that P is 7? But thanks for the clarification. Everything I say will certainly be valid when P is 7. Okay, so another way of stating this fact is that, if M has low rank, then X transpose MX can be written as a function of a few linear phases. So that is to say, Q of X is some bounded function B of L1 of X up to Lt of X, where these are all linear. And that certainly is something that one can hope to recreate at higher levels. So I don't really know whether this is quite the most correct definition of rank, but certainly a definition of rank is the following. So we say that let D be a degree, and I guess let's take a polynomial. Q from F7 to the n to F7, and we say that the D rank, so rank sub D of Q, is less than or equal to M if Q can be written as a function of at most M polynomials of degree D. So where degree Pi is less than D, and B is just some function from F to the M to F. So I guess you could say that the D rank of Q is the least M that will work in that definition. So the theorem in the paper is that a polynomial can only be biased if it has low rank. So suppose that the characteristic is, P, I guess, is bigger than D. So I guess it doesn't work over the field F7, but it does for sort of cubics and so on. So suppose the characteristic is bigger than D. Suppose that the polynomial Q is biased, so expected value over X, e to the 2 pi I over little p, Q of X is at least delta, then the D minus 1 rank, where Q is a polynomial of degree D, then the D minus 1 rank of Q is bounded. So it's bounded by O of 1, where the O depends on delta and phi. So the only way that a cubic polynomial can be biased is if it's secretly a function of boundedly many quadratics. So that was by myself and Tan, and actually very recently in a very nice paper. Shachar Lovett has just removed the characteristic assumption. So now one knows, for example, that if you have a cubic phase function on F2 that takes a value 1 51% of the time and 0 49% of the time, it is, well, the bound that would come out of his proof is a function of 10 to the 10 to the 10 to the 10 to the 10 quadratics. Actually, I've alluded there to an interesting issue. This is a very, very ineffective bound. And I think with a question as basic as this, one really ought to know whether this is, in fact, there are polynomial dependencies here. So I don't really see any reason why this shouldn't be of the form, at least sort of, delta to the minus some constant, depending on D. I certainly don't have a counterexample to that. But the bound that comes out of our proof is one of these sort of tower-type log star bounds. So that's a somewhat weird situation. Let me give some indication of how that's proved. Oops. So the first step, which gets you almost all the way to this theorem, is a lemma of Bogdanov and Viola. So this is a very, very nice lemma. It's the hypotheses are the same. So suppose Q is a polynomial of degree D, and that there's some bias. So expected value of x e to the 2 pi I over p of Q of x is at least delta. Then there exist boundedly many polynomials of degree D minus 1. Polynomials P1 up to PT, each of degree D minus 1. And here the dependence on T is actually quite sensible. And the way I'm going to state it, it's actually bounded by delta to the minus 5, I believe, such that, and a function B from F to the... Actually, I called this M before. Let me call that M again. So the function B from F to the M to F, such that Q agrees with that function of P1 up to PM 99% of the time. And of course, by 99%, I actually mean 1 minus sigma for whatever sigma you happen to need at some later stage in the argument. So I didn't want to give too many proofs, but I will just in 5 minutes sketch the argument here, because it's... this is one of these things... This came out of the computer science literature, and I certainly know that the argument for this is not in my own toolbox. I believe it wasn't in Terry Tao's toolbox, which is quite a strong statement. It's very, very simple. Quite subtle, but fairly short. So the sketch proof. Let me define probability measures. Mu sub r on fp. So this is all unbelievably finite. I mean, this is a set of size 7 or whatever. Just a by the probability of t. Well, sorry, mu sub r of t is the probability that P of X is T plus R. Sorry, this is Q. Q is my polynomial of degree D. If I choose X at random. So all of these measures are just rotations of each other. So mu of 0 is just the push forward under Q of the uniform measure on F to the N. And so the fact that Q is biased is essentially equivalent to the fact that these measures are somewhat separated. So actually this specific assumption on bias here tells you that the L1 norm of the distance between any two distinct such measures is at least 2 delta over the size of the field F. I mean, Q is not roughly constant. It's slightly biased away from being taking each value equally. So when you shift that measure, it can't be almost invariant under shift, because we're in FP. So if it were, then it would be almost constant. So that's a one-line deduction. So the measures are separated. Now, suppose, let's fix X, and I'm going to pick H at random. And let's look at the derivative of Q. And look at delta sub H of Q, which is defined to be just Q of X plus H minus Q of X. Now, so the probability that delta sub H of Q equals T is just by definition, that H is being chosen at random, is the probability over H that Q of X plus H equals Q of X plus T. Just the definition of the derivative. Now, if H varies randomly over everything, so does this. So does X plus H. And so this is just the same thing as mu sub Q of X of T. There's really, this is just an exercise in the definition. So now let's suppose you just take a load of random derivatives. Just pick several directions at random and take derivatives along all of them. So that's like taking a sample from this distribution here. So this is, for fixed X, this is a fixed distribution, and I've just sampled repeatedly from it. And as statisticians know, if you sample from a distribution sort of 1,000 times, you stand a pretty good chance, you can empirically write down roughly what the distribution had to have been. And actually, because those distributions are well separated, that gives you a pretty good idea what X had to be. So that's, I mean, I could probably add one more line of explanation. So the actual algorithm they use is to pick H1 up to, say, H1000 at random, and define Q tilde of X. Actually, I don't think I'll write it down. So what? Pick 1,000 random derivatives, write down the empirical distribution of them, and pick the R for which mu R most closely matches that empirical distribution. That will be close to Q of X 99% of the time, just by the law of large numbers. So it's a very simple argument, but somehow a little bit subtle, and not the sort of thing that many people would come up with, I don't think. So how do you go from 99% to 100%? So this lemma, although very clever, is really just one page. Going from 99 to 100% is the whole paper, essentially, by myself and Pat. So let's remember what position we're in. So we have a polynomial Q of degree D. And because I'm actually going to try and draw a picture or two, let me say it's of degree 3. And I have some quadratics, P1 up to P1000, let's say. So they're of degree 2. And Q of x is equal to some function of those quadratics 99% of the time. So that's what Bogdanov and Viola gave us. Now you can hope to bootstrap that 99% to 100% just by using, I mean, there's an awful lot of rigidity here. You've got a cubic polynomial on the left, quadratic polynomials on the right. You might have thought that you'd be able to use the fact that they're polynomials to just say that actually that relation has to hold everywhere. And so here's maybe how that might work. So let's divide f to the n into atoms according to the values of those 100 quadratics. So here it sort of looks like this. That's supposed to be f to the n, and here is, well, I'll just take two quadratics, which sort of cut it into level sets like this. Okay? And for 99% of the points in here, the left-hand side and the right-hand side of this agree. So sort of almost everywhere, we've got agreement. Now, as I said, because these are all polynomials, there are ways of forcing more agreement just for free. So one thing you can do, if inside one of these atoms, now this is tricky to draw, suppose you have a three-dimensional parallelepiped cube, and suppose you have 7 vertices for which this relation star is satisfied, so I know that Q is constant for those 7 points, because it depends only on P1 up to P100, and of course I know that P1 up to P1000, they're also constant. Now the fact that a quadratic satisfies, I need a four-dimensional parallelepiped to do this. So just imagine, people at the back, I'm sure this is completely clear. I've drawn a four-dimensional parallelepiped inside that small box there. Now Q being a cubic space implies that Q cancels over four-dimensional parallelepipeds. And so if I have 15 vertices of a parallelepiped for which star holds, it also holds for free for the 16th. And there are other similar games that you can play, sort of across different atoms. So I'm just going to end up with a huge mess. But you can certainly imagine that if we sat down over coffee or something, I'd be prepared to draw for you a four-dimensional parallelepiped across some of these atoms. And those, you get extra points coming. If you've got 15 points of such a thing, you often get a 16th for free. Right, so it's just a case of finding plenty of four-dimensional parallelepipeds for which star holds for 15 of the points out of 16. And because star actually holds for 99% of points globally, you might hope that that's a pretty easy thing to do. And I wish that that were so. I sort of still feel that there ought to be an easier argument for this. But the only way that we know how to do this, so we can only handle... Yeah, so you can certainly believe that as I say, if you've got lots of parallelepipeds, you're okay. But you need to know at least something about where those parallelepipeds are. So we need a good supply of four-dimensional parallelepipeds, 15 of whose vertices satisfy star. Now, by a good supply, I don't just mean lots of them. They also have to sort of lie within the right atoms. The only way we know of getting that is to first refine those quadratic polynomials down and make them sort of rank separated. Now, Tim was mentioning this in his talk yesterday. If those quadratics are highly rank separated, then the picture I've drawn here is actually very regular. So all of those atoms are about the same size, and you can count very accurately how many parallelepipeds there are inside each one. Also, you can count the number of parallelepipeds inside across different atoms. And it's worse than that, actually, because if you think carefully about what one needs, even if you've got 99% of an atom, you need to know that there are lots of parallelepipeds inside that good 99%. So it's not good enough just to know that there are many parallelepipeds inside the atom. You need to also know that they can't all have, you know, they don't all have two vertices inside that errant 1% in the bottom right corner. So an awful lot of configuration counting has to be done, and to make that work, you really need those polynomials to be rank separated. The only way we know of getting this rank separation is by an algorithm. So if I have 1,000 quadratics, either they're rank separated or they're not. If they're not, you can, they're in basically the span of 999 quadratics plus a few linears. And now you can iterate that. And eventually you will get rank separation. Now you can imagine that as you push this up to higher degrees, it gets very, very bad. So you want to get, suppose now I've got these cubics here. Either they're rank separated or I can kind of kick one out and it depended on some lower quadratics. But somehow this sort of funneling down from the top causes a huge amount of spreading out amongst the lower degree polynomials. And that's why you get this sort of log star bound. So there's a rough sketch of the argument, and I would, as I say, I'd love to see something a little bit softer that uses less structure here. Actually, I think I'll stop.